Hey, you're listening to the Creative Pep Talk podcast. We help you build a thriving creative career. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza. You can stay up to date with all things Creative Pep Talk by following me on Instagram at Andy J. Pizza. Let's jump into today's episode. This week's episode is brought to you by Wix.com. With Wix, the web is your playground. Start with a blank page as far as the eye can see, and you can design a website in any layout you want. Work right on the web page with advanced features and sophisticated visual effects. It's almost science fiction. You'll have the freedom to tell your story exactly the way you always envisioned it. Remember back in the day when you were a young toddler dreaming about a website that could do the functions that you've always dreamt it could do, but you knew, I'll never know code. I'm not like that. I don't have that in my future. But now you do with Wix. With Wix, you do. Go to wix.com/creativepep to get started today. That's wix.com/creativepep. Wix. What will you create? This week's episode is also brought to you by Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community for creators. It means there's online classes for you types of people. With more than 25,000 classes in design, business, and more, you'll discover countless ways to fuel your creativity, your curiosity, your career. Take some classes in social media marketing, mobile photography, creative writing, or even illustration. Whether you're looking to discover a new passion, wow, start a new side hustle, or gain new professional skills, okay, Skillshare is there to keep you learning, thriving, reaching, pushing, punching. Don't punch anybody. There's no Taekwondo on there yet. Think Skillshare? Another. Anyway, in reaching those new goals, 2 free months for free of Skillshare. Go to skillshare.com/creativepep. You got nothing to lose. Go watch some videos and learn something. Today on the show, we have my friend Jessica Hish. This is part two. I interviewed her a few years ago for the show. She comes back to grace us with her incredible creative career wisdom. If you don't know Jessica Hish, what are you doing with your life? My goodness, Jessica, you know, this is one of those situations where I am fortunate enough to have someone who was kind of like a digital mentor to me. I mean, she didn't know it, but I was following her career even before we met, learned so much about how to craft really fantastic personal projects from her and listen to her talks and just learn so much from her, and then met her in person, became friends, and here we are several years after the fact. Jessica Hish, if you don't know her, what's going on? She's worked with a few companies. You might have heard of them. Things like Apple, Nike, NPR, Vanity Fair, Washington Post, Wes Anderson. She created the font for the film Moonrise Kingdom. I mean, it can't be beat. And now that wasn't enough. She had to become a New York Times bestselling kids author and illustrator with her book, Tomorrow I'll Be Brave. It is freaking gorgeous. If you got any kids in your life, even if you don't, go on the computer or go in your local bookstore, go find this book and just buy a bunch of copies and then just go out on the street and start handing them out. Nobody will be upset with you. This thing is freaking gorgeous. My kids love this book. We're waiting for the follow-up, but I got to sit down with Jessica and talk her through what she learned through the process of making this book, as well as just catch up on some general creative career quandaries and what have you. We, you know, just talk shop and whatnot and have just a conversation, okay? That's what we do, and you're going to enjoy it. Here she is, the wonderful, the magnificent Jessica Hish. Audio weirdo. They get very serious about audio, you know, yeah. These kind of people.
I think most people are just fine as long as there's not a bunch of trucks.
Yeah, if it's not bonkers, then it's all right. Even if there's a little ambiance, I don't think it matters too much.
Oh yeah, yeah. My main thing when listening to anything is as long as everybody's at the same volume, I'm happy.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So if you're using the same technique, it's all right. So thanks for doing this. I'm glad. I hope it wasn't hard to get here or anything.
No. I was like, I had no idea how far away you would be from Central Columbus.
Yeah, not
but
very,
I was like,
not
this is like
bad.
25 minutes or something.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
So I have a bunch of things to ask you, obviously. Okay. I was going to use the same joke I used last time, which is, I heard you're the proud new mother of... And last time I said the printing press.
Oh, yeah.
This time I'm saying a New York Times best-selling book.
Yeah, that's true. Although it feels like, even though that's new in terms of the grand scheme of things, it doesn't feel...
It feels old news.
It feels like old news now just because I've been on this crazy book tour for so long.
Does it feel... does it not have the shininess of a new achievement anymore?
Well, I think like the thing that's really... amazing about the New York Times thing is that it's one of those evergreen achievements, and it's really hard to have those. And you know, there's not a lot of those that exist, especially
no,
in like the design world and things like that.
No.
Because a lot of the ones that are evergreen for a while are tied to your age,
right?
Which
like
then,
Young Guns or
Young Guns or you know any of the 30 under 30 stuff. Which is super cool if when you're in that zone.
Yeah.
But then when you start...
Then it kind of haunts you later.
Past that zone, and then you're just like, oh, this is actually...
I used to be 30 under 30.
Yeah, if people are introducing me when I'm like turning 40 as like someone that was a 30 under 30, I'll be like, no, that just makes me sound like I haven't done anything in 10 years. You know, so that's the thing that's really, really cool about it.
Yeah, that is really cool. I feel like... one of my only things like that, I feel like, is working with the New York Times, and I only did it one time, but I feel like that was one where I was like, all right, I got that. For the rest of my life, people can introduce me as,
he works with
people like the New York Times. Like,
yeah, I do.
Clientlists
are that. I also feel like if you ever get into any annual, it is that.
Right.
Like, you don't get more cred for getting in every year, which is why, I don't actually send stuff every year.
I've never sent anything.
Yeah.
I think it's because I went to college in England, so I missed the... I don't know. By the time I got here, I felt like, I don't know what this is. I don't know what these people are doing or... whatever, but I think you're right.
So, I do it every now and then. You know, like when ComArts started doing their typography annual, I was like, oh, I should probably submit to this. But now I don't really submit to things.
Just kidding. We're very involved.
Clearly very community involved.
Yeah,
up
true.
To my AIGA
yes,
membership
true.
To be like leader level because I'm supposed to.
Right.
I have on and off years of submission just because I just can't stay on top of all that stuff.
No.
You know, like someone was complaining about how they like feel pressure to update their portfolio on a weekly basis or something.
On a weekly basis?
And I was like, oh my God, like I have updated my portfolio like twice in the last 4 years and I've only done it out of guilt and I've added like two or three random pieces, not like the bulk of my work.
Yes. So, okay. The first thing I was going to ask you about is kind of, I have ADHD. I don't know if we talked about that last time, but sometimes I just like to say that at the beginning of a conversation.
I like a meandering conversation. We're good.
It's going to go all over the place. But I heard somewhere, I heard you say that you were quiet growing up. Is that right?
Oh, that is true. Yeah.
And what, so why, I don't think of you as quiet. I don't think of... Probably the people that know you for your work don't probably think of you that way. So why?
It was,
what is that?
Was totally fueled by being extremely concerned about what other people think.
Yeah.
You know, and not wanting to disappoint everyone. And just like, I think I was so receptive and, you know, like I just loved adoration and getting praise and being told that I was good and doing things right. That anything that made that not happen, I was absolutely terrified of because I got all of my self-worth out of what other people said to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Do you... sorry.
Oh, yeah, no, please.
But do you feel like... do you have like words of affirmation as like a love language? Do you subscribe to that?
Yeah. So okay. Words of affirmation, they're actually not at the top for me anymore, but I do think that they used to be.
Yeah.
But they're not at the bottom, you know, like there's somewhere like
some growth and change, but
there's somewhere
it's still
around
there.
Two or three, you know, like I definitely still get off on people telling me I'm awesome.
Yeah, sure.
But I feel like now I need it.
Yeah.
Only when I'm in moments of like self-doubt.
Like a down
moment. I don't need it to maintain. I need it just as a fixer.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. When you're feeling particularly low or something.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Why did that, what changed about that then?
I think like one thing that changed was just wanting to participate more in like, you know, society, quote unquote, at large, but also, you know, when it came to feeling like I finally found a community, like when the design community, like, was present in front of me.
Yeah.
Just being like, oh my God, these are my people. Mm. I want to be a part of this. And knowing that in order to be a part of it, I couldn't be like a wallflower. Mm-hmm. And then in order to participate, I was just exchanging with someone a little bit on the internet about this a day or two ago, that I felt so comfortable posting my stuff online and engaging with people online as long as I came from a place of personal experience and personal opinion, not empirical.
Right.
Like truth
like these
or anything
are the
like
rules
that.
Or
yeah,
whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So, because nobody wants to hear from like a 24-year-old being like, here's the best way to manage your life.
Right.
You know, like, but what they do want to hear is like, oh, hey, I just learned a new thing. This really helped me in learning this thing. It might help you learn this thing. I'm not saying I'm an expert, but I just learned this thing
and
that might be helpful. This is my experience. And doing that, like sort of framing it as personal experience is way more bulletproof to criticism.
Yeah.
Really helped me.
True,
and then when
I
started looking back at my teenage years and things like that, I was so jealous of the girls, mostly girls, you know, like, because dudes are going to be dudes, whatever.
Right. Yeah.
But like the girls that were my age that seemed to be like super alpha in kind of like a bitchy way.
Yeah.
But like it wasn't actually bitchy. It was just they were really good at just laying it out there of what they wanted and what their ideal thing would be.
It's funny
and then
that
everyone
it would
else
seem as bitchy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's like a...
Maybe it's just a stereotype.
I think it's a stereotype. Yeah. It's a women thing. You know, like, you know, a lot of people think
of
assertive women.
Strong women.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was totally guilty of having that thought, too.
Yeah, sure.
But really, like, in retrospect, you look back at it and you say, like, oh, my God, like, this is how everyone should be if everyone could just state their intentions and their preferences, but then be receptive to other people's preferences and malleable to whatever the group consensus is, then it's great.
Yeah.
You know, like if you think about the last time you went out to dinner with a group of people, like you're always really grateful when someone goes, well, how does everyone feel about sushi?
Right.
You know, because it gives an opinion, a thing to have an opinion about. Whereas like when everyone just stands around and waffles and doesn't want to say what they want because they don't want to piss the crowd off, then it's really frustrating. And then you end up going to like a non-restaurant because nobody made a decision.
That just pleases everybody or
whatever.
But I feel like, so, you know, I've been in the design illustration world for 10 years. I don't feel particularly nervous or self-conscious in those environments. I feel pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel as though as I move into new territories, especially when it's people that I want their approval, like you were saying that these are my people, to me that almost feels like added nerves.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I really want these people to like me. So what, you know, you didn't feel that way like
early on? I think...
But I guess you had a lot of stuff happen really quickly, too.
And I think, you know, even working for Louise was a way to, like, learn a lot about humility, like, early on and the importance of it.
Yeah, right.
Because I think, like, you know, if I had worked at some agency for some, like, bullheaded, like, random agency personality.
Yeah, right. Someone you didn't maybe respect in terms of craft.
Or someone that, you know... They felt that the best way to navigate the world is to kind of be the strong-armed bully instead of, you know, whatever. I just kind of, like, learned a lot about, like, respect your elders, respect the process, like, all this kind of stuff, which made me want to speak less to the people older than me right. and more to the people just under me. And like they were my people initially.
Right.
Okay. I was like, hey guys, I'm out here in the world. Let me tell you about how this is working. Let me help you navigate this since you're only a step behind me.
Yeah.
And I don't want you to have to walk through the same piles of nonsense that I might have had to walk through.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's interesting too. I always think about if I ever give any advice about networking, it's always that, which is, I feel like networking, people get it in their mind that it's something about climbing a ladder or like trying to reach those ahead of you. Mm-hmm. And actually, in my experience, looking to the sides of me and people behind me and connecting with them and being, you know, helpful and useful to those people, that like a lot of great things come, more great things come from that than trying to be friends with my heroes or something like that.
Does that make sense? And I mean, what ends up establishing your expertise in a field are not the experts telling you you have expertise.
Yes, totally true.
You know, it's the people that are learning from you saying that the things that you're teaching them are valuable.
Are working. And
working.
Yeah, yes, yeah, totally.
Like, you know, experts are only experts if people believe they, if people that they
yeah, it's like a consensus
under
of
them
people
them.
Saying
yeah.
this is an expert. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. If it's not like an on paper thing, you know, like clearly you can be an
like
expert
a certificate.
Just because you've
like
been certified.
Like you're a surgeon.
Yeah, right? exactly. Yeah. Which like, you know, there's a certain amount of work that goes into receiving those accolades where it's like understood and it's easier to just like look at an accolade and say like, oh, well, clearly you must have expertise because you've been studying a thing for 8 years and now have this certificate saying that you were competent enough to get a certificate.
Right.
You know, yes, but in the art field, there's not a lot of that. You
there
know,
isn't a lot of that. Yeah. There's a lot of it's based on social proof for people. Yeah. Kind of coming together and agreeing.
And longevity too. I mean, like, cause you can say one thing once, but if you don't consistently, you know, pay attention and stay on top of stuff, then people are like, oh, wait, you're not an expert in the field. You're an expert on a specific topic.
On this little thing.
And
yeah,
that specific
true.
Topic
yeah.
now has been written about a million times, so therefore you become less relevant.
Yeah, that's interesting. I might circle back to that because it's really interesting, but there's a question that I have. This is one of my big questions for you. Mm-hmm. So you've accomplished probably, I'm guessing, more than you thought you were going to, possibly?
Yes, but the thing is, I only in that I didn't stop to think I would accomplish anything.
Right. Okay.
You know, like when I don't know if I had goals when I was younger.
Okay.
And I think part of that
younger
is...
Younger what?
Like, you know...
Like,
I mean,
before you got into the industry
yeah,
or
like
once you got...
before yeah, I got okay. into the industry. And then once I got into the industry... You know, I just enjoyed making stuff so much.
Yeah.
I never felt like, oh my God, like, what is this crazy, I've won the lottery. You know, like, I don't know if I ever had that feeling.
Right. Yeah.
But I have always felt very grateful just that like, oh man, I grew up wanting to draw all day and I found a way to get paid to draw all day.
Yeah. Yes.
And like now I do feel like I end up looking at, you know, I have to check myself a lot and pay attention to what younger folks are saying.
Yeah.
Just because, like, it's really easy to lose track of how... Sorry.
It doesn't matter. It's totally fine. This is cash.
It's cash. Random vibrating thing in the background.
At first, I thought it was a bass note. I was like, is somebody putting on, like, crazy music? All right.
But, yeah, like, I don't know. It's really difficult to lose sight of how blessed you are in that circumstance unless you are looking at people a few steps behind you.
True.
And being like, oh my God, like, how did I win the lottery and end up in this thing?
But if, for instance, you 12 years ago, knowing that you were gonna have a New York Times bestseller, work with Wes Anderson, whatever, all the other things that you could say, what would that person, I mean, would that, do you think that would have exceeded their thoughts of this is where this career is going to go or not?
Yes.
yeah. Like, I mean, I don't know if that's a weird question,
it's
but.
It's really hard to describe just because, like, I think I've always been a person that's been like a low expectations person my own life and my career, or not even like I'm a person that can be happy without all of the craziness, you know, like, and I have to like, I'm really grateful for that because it keeps me from freaking out after I get a thing of, like, what's the next thing?
This is where the question's coming from, by the way.
Because, like, I think it would be really sad if a thing happened that was amazing and then I just could not, like, appreciate it because I was like, what's the next thing?
Yeah.
I have that a little bit. Like, I do have a hard time, like, living in the moment, which I think, like, all people do.
Sure.
But I don't feel like I feel ungrateful for the thing that has happened. It's more that
I'm afraid
to celebrate it too much because I don't want that thing to define me and put me in cruise control and make it be a thing that, you know, takes over the whole business.
Yeah.
You know, so I end up moving on really quickly after getting an accolade rather than just like stewing in it in a positive way for a long time. Cause I'm like, oh, this is a flash in the pan. Nobody's gonna care about this soon. Yeah. You know, like, or, and like if I spend too much time focusing on it or, you know, putting it at the forefront, then all of a sudden it's going to date me or it's going to make it seem like stagnate whatever I'm doing now is not important.
Yeah. I think, do you feel like I think that creative people, creative professionals of all kinds, like you see it in acting and comedy and everybody, thinks a lot about that career perception or the career trajectory, like just what you're talking about, like nobody wants to be known for a certain single. Like nobody, you know, is that kind of what that feeling is, do you think?
It is. Yeah. And I think that it only comes because I did skyrocket up to a certain level at a very young age.
So that's something you're thinking about.
And so something that I tell people a lot when I'm doing public speaking stuff is like, do not freak out that you are not where you think you're supposed to be.
Right.
Because it is so much easier to climb the mountain than it is to balance yourself on the top of the mountain for a very long time. You know, like what you really should do is try to pace out your career as much as you can so that you are always climbing. You always feel like you're on just sort of a nice upward walk in which you are going to get to that top of the mountain when you are in your 40s or like wherever, like whenever that happens.
Yeah.
So then when you have to balance at the top of it, you're not balancing for 30 years. You know, you're balancing for 15 years and then you write your book or then you teach or whatever, because like racing to the top of the mountain seems like the right thing because you want to get those 30 under 30s or you want to get whatever it is that is the, you know.
There's like, there's also like the sexiness of young genius, like, like exploding onto the scene. Let's talk about that. How about, because I feel like it's been, that period of your life has been long enough ago where you probably have worked through all kinds of things and I mean, and you're in a good place because you've hit a bunch of accolades that are far surpassing the early craziness even. Does that make sense?
So like my biggest concern is staying relevant for my whole career.
Yes.
Like that's my biggest fear and concern is like I don't want to be one of those people that like made awesome stuff in their 20s and then is still talking about that awesome stuff in their 20s when they're in their 50s and 60s. And that's like the only thing people want to ask them about. And then what ends up happening is like whether or not that's you still want to hear that conversation is one thing, but like I don't want to be the one telling those stories. You know, like
you don't want to be playing your hit from age 22.
Yeah, yeah. I want to. I'm fine resurfacing a hit.
Sure.
But I want to do it as the
encore. It's not like you're not going to play it.
But I have new stuff. Yeah, exactly. Like if you show up, I'll tell you about the hit. But I don't want the hit to be the only thing that everybody wants to hear. And like I just remember being in my 20s and going to conferences and, you know. Especially when I would go to web conferences and things like that. Like sometimes I would hear murmurs in the audience of just like, what has this person made lately? You know, really being very judgmental about people that like speak for a living and teach for a living versus people that make for a living.
Yep.
Now on the other end of that, what I can say is that like the skills to teach are very different than the skills to make and that you should not discount a speaker or teacher like because they have not made like a bananas project in the last 10 years. Because like people that make awesome stuff are often not very good at talking about it.
Right.
You know, but I do think that there's a lot of naive people that don't understand that. And I want to be able to like, you know, be a person that their work legitimizes the words that they're saying.
Totally.
Forever.
Yeah, 100%. You know? I think about this a lot for millions of reasons. Do you feel like, because you kind of said that it's one of your main drivers in that
yeah.
spiel. I just don't know. Sorry.
Yeah, no,
I don't really
totally.
Call it a spiel. But just what you just said. And I wonder, sometimes I think about this a lot, about how much am I driven by, I am very driven by things that I've heard people say about people that I'm in the situation of now, just yeah. like you just said.
Yeah.
And I wonder, some of it is kind of ends up being toxic to me.
Yeah, I think like...
I'm not judging you.
No, no,
I'm just
totally.
Trying to...
It can be, but only actually like, I feel like it's only toxic when you value that individual person's opinion. Like, you know, if that person is doing like cool stuff and
yeah.
involved in stuff that you couldn't dream of being involved in because you just missed the boat on it or whatever,
yeah.
then you take that to heart. It's
right.
like hard to not. But... if it's just some random
yeah.
young person saying a thing, I'm like, oh, you're just naive.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
so it's easy for me to, like, kind of block it out if I don't have a real intense reason to respect their opinion.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, I think that's a good filter. I think the other thing I try to do is figure out, because you're going to hear all these different opinions, which of them actually align with your own values.
Like, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
So if you felt that way... if you feel similar to about those people that they're criticizing or whatever, then it might be a good lens to help keep you on track.
Yeah, right? And I think too, you know, people are intelligent in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And I think the older that you get, the more you start understanding that there's all these variables that like are raised and lowered on every single person.
Right.
And just because someone is like a genius intellectually doesn't mean they are a genius in terms of like emotional availability and empathy.
Right.
And so
yeah.
like there are people that will say things that just make absolutely no sense in terms of like the human experience,
right.
but might come from like
yeah.
an empirical evidence like place.
Right. Yeah.
And you're
true.
Just like, you're like, no matter how, you're so dumb, no matter how smart you are, you know? Like,
yeah.
And like if you filter people out based on that, it's really easy to sort of be like, oh, well, you'll just never understand this thing because you don't have the nuts and bolts needed to understand this thing.
Right. That's good. I do think, like, I think my only problem with that is sometimes it's hard for me personally, and I'm putting, you know, myself in my audience's shoes, probably uh-huh. feel similar. Sometimes it's the people that dislike the type of person you are that you value or you consider their critique more than anybody else.
That can happen.
I don't know if I do that, but I'm not saying you do that.
I definitely do that sometimes. And part of that, it depends on how confident you are in yourself.
Sure.
Because it can get you super riled up.
Yeah.
If you're like, I'm a good person.
Yeah.
Fuck you. You know, like, and yeah. like, you know, like, what, you don't like positive human beings?
Right.
Like, you know, like, whatever. And then you just get really, like, it just, like, makes your blood boil
sure.
when people get upset about things like that. And I think that that protecting myself from that
yeah.
is possibly one of the reasons why I do so much, like, community stuff. You know, like, because I feel like a lot of times every time I do something that is like, oh, let me respond to this email of this person that is writing me in a crisis and
mm-hmm.
I want to try and help them. You know, those help validate my own feelings about myself that
sure.
I am in this for the right reasons.
Yep.
And they helped like put up a wall between me and the people that try to criticize me.
Yes. So, okay.
So in a way, like, you know, like nobody ever does anything like truly altruistically,
no,
like, you know,
no.
But I think that like a lot of the reasons why I give so much back, it feels really good to do it.
Sure.
And part of the reason why it feels really good to do it is because it feels like a fortification system
yeah.
when I do get criticized.
Yes. And I was going to pull that thread, but I'm going to try not to. I was going to pull the thread of, there's a weird thing about, like, I was listening to an Hidden Brain. You listen to that
no,
ever?
I don't.
Okay. I think it's an NPR podcast, and it's just neurology and all that good stuff. and they were talking about the actual left and right brain. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of popular culture around it that's not accurate, obviously, mm-hmm. But that it's basically left brain is like details and right brain is big picture.
Yeah.
And I feel like there is a weird thing about creative business that's both of these things. And you just even saying in it for the right reasons, it's such a weird burden for a creative person.
Oh, totally.
Because you're...
And, you know, I try, whenever I see friends apologizing for earning money on, a project or whatever, I'm just like, you don't need to apologize to make, like, because you're making money. Like,
yes.
It doesn't make your work less valuable because you decided to monetize
it. How crazy is that? Like, it's less valuable because it's valued with money.
Yeah.
It's like the craziest thing. But, okay, let's talk about this, your journey with, I think from the outside, it's easy for people to be like, she had this explosive career. It must have been amazing. Working through that kind of quick rise, as you said, like balancing on a mountain, what were the hardest parts of that?
You know, I don't know if I want to start with the hardest parts of it. I think I'll start with an observation that I have like come to realize over the last like few years.
Yeah.
Is that people that ascend to like the pop like well-knownness in their field, there's like classes of people and they are all friends with each other. Mm-hmm. And it just is like part of it is like a right place at the right time, but that doesn't necessarily mean right physical place.
Right.
You know, like clearly you live over here in Ohio, mm-hmm. but we are part of the same creative class of people in their mid-30s that are doing stuff and came on the scene at the same-ish time.
Yep.
You know, and I think that if you are participating in the design world or in whatever world your world is, it's easy to find your people if your work is like baseline interesting. Like it doesn't need to be like the world's best stuff, but you have to be like a relatively decent person that wants to elevate the people around you as much as you want to elevate yourself.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to just like hang out and be a friendly person.
Yep.
And what I've noticed is that like my time in New York was incredibly valuable to me like professionally, just because I ended up a part of like a class of people, you know, like there. And I noticed it because, you know, I was just with Emily Oberman over at a conference.
Okay.
And I was saying that her and Paul Sayre and Brian Ray and James Victori and like all these people were another class.
Right.
You know, they were like the class above us and they're all friends with each other. They all still talk. They all used to go on vacation together. Mm-hmm. And these things just kind of happen. And it's like every 10 years. And if you can find your way into one of those classes, whether it's the leading one, the, like, you know, or one of the many subgroups of them, then all of a sudden you feel this intense community around you. And I think that your work ends up getting elevated just by association of the people that are around you.
And, you know, osmosis of being around great people, it improves you and you you level up. But I, one of the things I didn't realize for a long time, probably years and years after it happened, was that I didn't realize how big of a deal living relatively near London was when I graduated. Uh-huh. And how the people that, same as you're describing, how that, if I hadn't done that, had I just stayed in Indiana, even, that I don't know if I could have bridged that chasm.
Yeah, and that's why it's really hard to answer that question of, like, do you think you need to live in New York or, like, whatever?
It is.
And
it is, yeah.
It's hard to answer it because, like, the answer should be no.
Yeah.
But the answer is there are major benefits to moving closer to a really active creative community.
Yeah.
You know, because just physical presence in a creative community makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Like there are a lot of, even if you think about the New York Times, you know, like the majority of illustrators that they hire for op-ed and all that kind of stuff are people living in New York because it's everybody knows each other.
Yeah.
And that's just something that happens.
Yeah.
And no matter how much you try and fight against it or say it's not right, it happens. And it's much harder to dig in if you're not physically located close to people.
Totally. I almost feel like you know, I feel like with the invention of the internet, which I think only people over 30 would ever say that.
Yeah.
With the invention of the internet, I think everybody thought that it would make it so that geography was not a factor.
Yeah.
And it almost made it a premium. It's like even more important to get FaceTime with people.
Well, what it means is that you have to work so much less hard. It's
right.
a tax
yeah.
to live outside of these cities.
Yes.
You know, like, it's still 100% possible to be super involved in the creative community, and you're saving so much money living out in
yeah.
smaller cities.
Totally.
And you're able to, like, live a more comfortable life and have things and eventually have a house and, like, all this stuff that people in New York and people in LA just cannot have.
Yeah.
But you are paying the tax of having to work way harder to stay involved in the career, and they are paying the tax of not having
the actual tax
of never having a savings account,
yeah.
of living in tiny shithole places. You know, like, their tax is different than your tax, but you each have a tax.
Yeah.
So it just depends on how you want to spend your taxes, like what you want your tax to be.
Yep.
Do you want your tax to be on time and, like, you know, really having to push yourself to be involved? Or do you want your tax to be like a literal financial tax where
yeah.
you just never have any money and it's impossible for you to buy a house and do all the things that we hope to have in our 30s and 40s?
Yeah. I remember early 20s looking at Tad Carpenter and learning that, because I was living in Indiana at the time and watching him in Kansas City and just be like, he's doing like 8 times the work.
That guy works so hard.
He works so hard. Yeah, so it makes me feel terrible. But I thought, man, you know, I would see him kind of get recognition several years later
yeah.
than people in his same class. And it would take him 3 times the amount of work. And, you know, I just thought, man, if I'm going to choose to live in the Midwest, I'm going to have to follow that. I'm going to have to have.
And I think that that's kind of true. But the thing that is good is if you can put in your time for
somewhere.
I
always say you don't have to live in New York forever.
No.
Yeah.
Live there for 3 to 5 years. Or live somewhere.
If it's possible for you.
And that you can ride off of that for so long.
Totally.
Just that connection that you had to those people.
Yeah.
And that is such a big help. And so, like, I definitely advise, like, if you are just an unencumbered young person and can move to a creative community wherever it is, it doesn't have to be New York, it's Chicago, you know, like, wherever. I think it can be just so powerful on the next 10 years of your life. Just in terms of, like, social capital stuff and just, like, feeling a part of that time. It's crazy.
It is.
Hey, come over here. Look at this phone. Do you know what that is? That's premium. That's a premium website right there. Made that thing with Wix.com. Wix.com? Have you heard about it? All the cool kids are going on there making websites. That's what we're doing these days. Go try it. Wix.com/creativepep. You can get started today for free and just start messing around, seeing what you can do. I guarantee you, man, you're going to find something fun and fresh and funky while you're going about creating this website. All jokes and weirdness aside, there wasn't really any jokes in there, but it was definitely strange what I just said. I use Wix, and here's what I like about them. They're trying to be the best platform for creative people to build their websites, and they're putting money into the creative professional world. They are backing all kinds of different creators to help them and work with them and find what tools creatives want to build their portfolio sites, their websites, their band sites, all that good stuff. Go see what's possible. Wix.com/creativepep to get started today. Wix, what will you create? We're also sponsored by Skillshare. Skillshare.com/creativepep. 2 months for free. Can't go wrong. Guess what? Our guest, Jessica Hiss, she has 3 classes on there. She has a logo masterclass. She has 2 lettering classes. By the way, if you don't know, go check out her lettering. She is a master letterer. Even if you're not into lettering, go check it out. There's like a basics class. You're going to learn some interesting things. But not only that, here's the thing.
this is what the worst part about Jessica is, that she's not just a visual master. She also happens to be entertaining. You know, I went and listened to her talk recently, and she was cracking me up. She's, you know, there's some like legitimate stand-up comedy bits in this thing. And so not only are you going to learn something, you're just going to be entertained. You're going to have a good time. She is super fun, and these classes are great. Go check it out. Skillshare.com/creativepep. Why not? That's their motto. That's not actually their tagline. But you should. Why not? Try it out. It's good. Okay. That's enough.
So, are you going to talk about struggles?
I will. The thing that I will talk about struggles.
What makes you not want to?
Because I feel like I didn't have as many as so many other people. I do feel like I was really lucky. And I think that, you know, I had some, like, my struggles weren't necessarily career-wise. You know, I, like, had struggles, like, in personal ways. But career-wise, I do feel like the good far outweighed the bad.
Right.
You know, I was definitely criticized as being, like, a young, silly girl with, like, big ideas and things like that. But it was so minimal compared to how many people helped me along the way and felt that I was like, whatever I was saying that was ridiculous and naive and whatever, it didn't matter because my heart was in the right place.
Right.
And it feels hard to talk about struggles because I do feel like
it feels ungrateful.
Like I'm just very grateful for all the people that were around me and how I never felt like, you know, I felt always this intense kinship with everybody that was my peers. I never felt this, like, destructive frenemy, you know, like, competitive nonsense that I feel like a lot of people end up feeling.
I think I'm just projecting onto you because I just can imagine having that much attention at that age and crumbling. Because, I'm 32 now, and I feel like I've never had more eyeballs, and with that you get a percentage of those are not going to be good. They're going to be, you know, critical and mean sometimes, and I don't handle it very well. And so I just imagine handling that 10 years ago and just being destroyed by it.
I think I had enough people that were older than me that were like really good at being like, Jessica, don't read the comments, you know, like, you know, stuff like that. Or,
and you probably felt safe with those kind of, some of these, like, if you were surrounded by industry leaders that had your back, you probably felt okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, anytime that some random schmo on the internet decided to, like, have a tirade
at
me,
try to take you down.
Yeah. I'm the first person to talk to literally every person I know about a thing that's bothering me. So I would be, like, instantaneously on Instant Messenger with every person that I knew that I could vent about it to, and they would be like, fuck that person, you know?
Yeah.
And then that would, like, I'd be like, yeah, you're right, you know? And then I would still, like, you know, it would haunt me at night for a little bit, but I would be able to feel a little bit more fortified because another person would share a story with me about a time that some person dragged them down into the mud and that it felt terrible, but it was such a blip and all you have to do is try to get through it.
It's another argument for having community, having those people around you, really.
Yeah, and also too, like, I think, like, the anonymity of the internet.
Yeah.
If you poke a hole in that, it is extremely powerful.
What do you mean by that?
If someone is calling you out, like, and criticizing you on the internet, and you reach out to them, not publicly, because if you start fighting with someone in a public forum, nobody looks good.
Right.
But if you reach out to them privately and be like, hey, man, I'm a person.
Yeah.
Like, if you have a problem.
I've had the same experience.
You know, if you reach out to them and go, like, I'm sorry that you feel that way about my work, but do you really need to drag it down in public?
Yes.
You know, and you call them out, like, in private, in a way, and then they still keep on their high horse of, I'm allowed to criticize, blah, 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 whatever.
Yeah.
Very few people actually stay on
True.
It. You know, it's really easy for people to think of you as a non-person if you, like, for anybody on the internet, but especially if you're a person with an audience on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, totally like, true. I had an issue like that with a person on Twitter where they would be, like, very openly critical about my stuff. And I just, like, like knew their IM handle somehow. Right. Because I think we had like people in common. Yeah. And so I wrote that person and I was like, hey man, you know, it doesn't feel good when you say these things like that. And he was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I can be such a curmudgeon sometime. Like, la la la. And was very apologetic and basically came at it as like a, I vent sometimes on the internet and I forget that other people read this, you know,
yeah.
And like, we've since remained friendly, like, yeah. You know, like ever since I did that.
I mean, like, I've had a few bad comments, but most of them are just like, Andy's not for me. And even that, I'm like, oh, why? I'm trying to be nice. Let's talk about your book. So what is the story of how that came about? Tomorrow I'll Be Brave.
Well, it came about in a few different ways. So I, for one thing, had no aspirations of making kids' books prior to having kids.
Which is pretty common, although it's not my story. A lot of my friends that are illustrators, it's their story.
Yeah, I mean, the main reason why it's my story is I hate making any project about a subject that I don't understand really thoroughly.
Yeah.
And that understanding didn't come to me naturally. So, like, right. If I'm assigned a thing to research... You know, like...
You can do that.
Like, yeah. I can do that, but I have to be, like, sort of given the right resources and whatever.
Like, you want to feel it, not, like, from a empathetic, but, like, a sympathetic, where you've experienced it.
Yeah.
You feel it's something like close to you.
All of my personal projects that I've ever made have come from a place of me being knee-deep in a subject matter or in a whatever and feeling like I need to make something in reaction to that subject matter. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I didn't want to even try making something for children before I understood what children were into.
Yeah.
You know, and I, you know, we all feel separated enough from our childhood by the time we're grown up. Usually.
Not me, but I'm just weird.
I mean,
I'm a weird person. I feel like I'm arrested development or something.
I think it all depends on how you bank memories and stuff too.
Right. Yeah.
Like
maybe.
I feel like I don't have a lot of really clear memories from childhood,
sure.
And I have them based on photographs and based on tales that my family have told
right.
me.
Yeah.
But I don't feel very connected to the person that I was as a child.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And so
interesting.
When you have a kid, though. You get reconnected to that person.
Yeah.
Because you like see it through their lives and you see what they're experiencing and it can help you tap into a place that you haven't tapped into in a long time
mm-hmm.
and like feel like you're experiencing, like, you know, you get very empathetic for how they're experiencing their lives. And so having kids was a big motivator. And another big motivator was just sort of having this realization that like lettering alone was not doing it for me anymore.
Right.
You know, like, I think a lot of people get into their careers in their 30s and 40s, and they're like, oh my God, how do I make work that's not just about celebrating graphic design anymore?
This is, by the way, my initial questions about goals and all that was getting to, at this age, at my, I just got to a place where it's the first time in the past 10 years where writing goals has taken me 3 months instead of 3 minutes.
Yeah.
So, which is, and I'm driven by goals and achievement and doing things. And I kind of had an existential crisis. Like, because mainly, as it's not this simple, but it's about as simple as the podcast got bigger than I thought it could. And then I worked with the New York Times. And I always, for the past 10 years, I thought that would be it.
Yeah.
And so then I got to a place where I was like, now what am I going to do? Like, I don't know.
That's why I think like, goal setting can be really hard.
I think
some people are very good at it and vision boarding and all that kind of stuff. But I'm just like, I get so disappointed when I achieve goals that I've set out to do that I just try not to have goals. Like, it's really weird, like, because I'm like, oh, well, that's it. You know, like, there's always, because the goal is never as big as you envision it in your head. You know, like,
yes,
working
right.
for the New York Times,
yeah.
huge deal before you've done it, and then you do it, and you're like, wow, I got paid $200, and it's a client.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
And everything turns into a job eventually.
Sure. Totally.
You know, like,
yeah.
everything, you know, like,
totally.
No matter how amazing and whatever things
but
are.
So lettering was, like, this enormous thing in your life, obviously still
yeah.
is, but there was, it kind of...
Like, I feel like... I still love to create lettering.
Sure.
But there was something about lettering, like when I got into it, where it felt like this weird hidden world that nobody knew about.
Sure, yeah.
Even
yeah.
though clearly people knew about it, but like it wasn't everywhere.
It's kind of like indie music in early 2000s, where you're like, whoa, late 90s or something. You're like, whoa, there's a whole other world, and now it's
It feels so like it's like the band that you discovered, and then when everybody else discovers that band, you're like, well, I still like this band, but are they my favorite band?
It doesn't
now?
Feel personal anymore.
It doesn't feel personal. Yeah, exactly.
That makes sense. And also, I wonder if like there's a pretty big shift there from learning to talk to having something to say. So like the forms of letters is very like learning to talk. You're like, you're not thinking as much about the copy or what saying, whereas writing a book is the words. Like you're making a comment, which is a different level. Did it feel like that?
Yeah. And as you progress in your career, like, I think it's always really exciting when you feel like you're on this really steep uptick of learning.
Sure.
You know,
totally.
And that's the same thing that you were just saying.
Yep.
And once you feel like you have a decent amount of knowledge, and then it's about like really pushing yourself around and experimenting and things like that, it gets really hard and scary.
Yeah.
And what I sort of realized was like, I'm not a very experimental person. Mm. Like Eric Marinovich, my studio mate, is super experimental. That dude can experiment on type and lettering all day long. And I am involved in like the type design community too, and those guys can literally just talk about like type all day long, trying new things, weirding out, like, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And what I realized was that like I didn't love it enough to have that be like the only thing.
Sure.
You know, like I think that lettering and illustration has been like and design has been an amazing thing in my life, but like I don't know if I will be the kind of designer that is like publishing tutorials until for like the next 20 years about design.
Yeah.
You know, I'm much more interested in like a broader humanity kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I also like, because I was so obsessed with lettering and so obsessed with myself identifying as a lettering artist, I weeded out any work that was not lettering because I'm like, I don't want to dilute the brand, quote unquote, even though like I never thought of myself as a brand, but I didn't want to dilute what people came to me for.
Sure.
And I wanted to make sure that like, oh, well, if people are calling me an expert in this thing, that I maintain my expertise by only doing this.
And if you are, if you're running a business, you have to have a certain level of trust around an area.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how you,
Yeah. And the way you get client work is specializing. You know, like it's good to be a generalist if you have a real job, and it's good to be a specialist if you're working for yourself.
Totally.
And what I sort of realized was I was having a total crisis because of, you know, like basically as soon as you don't have the ability to work 24 hours a day, which is like there's so much validation
in
just staying busy.
When you
have kids, you mean? Yeah, when you have kids. Or when you like, you know, honestly, it happened first when I moved to San Francisco.
Yeah.
Because I had friends with real jobs and nobody worked like I did when I was in New York.
Right.
And
yeah,
all of a sudden,
funny.
I would have these like evenings free constantly, you know. And then I was just like, "What am I even doing here?"
Yeah,
and then
like it felt a minute to stop and think about what's happening instead of just making stuff. Yeah.
And like because my days were shorter, I was turning down more work and not just filling my calendar. And then it felt like the work that I took on had more meaning and importance, and then I would question like, is this a thing I should do? Like, does this mean, like, you know, whatever, like, is this moving the needle in one way, shape, or form? And then all of a sudden there's all this pressure on the work that you take on that doesn't happen when you just stay busy all the time.
Sure.
You know, like I would talk at conferences and stuff when I was younger about like, hey, you want to pay me to draw a hamburger? I'll draw a hamburger.
Yeah.
Like, I was just so happy to get paid and so happy to be there.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, I hit this, like, moment in my, like, late 20s and 30s where I was just like, should I be drawing hamburgers? You know, like...
yeah, and, like an existential crisis.
Yeah, it was a total existential crisis. And then I was talking to my husband about this, and he was, like, he was reading this book about, I forget what it's called, like, it's, like, The Inventor's Dilemma or something like that. And it's all just about like Silicon Valley people that like what happens is they'll like invent a technology and then you have two choices. You either like stay with it and rise to the top and then just try to maintain as much as possible your expertise, or you have to totally abandon it and do a new thing because eventually all things decline.
Right.
You know, like if you invent a new technology, that technology is not going to ascend for the rest of your life. It's going to like have a life cycle that it eventually goes away.
Yep.
And you have to figure out when to get off that thing so that you can do the thing that is the next thing that you want to invent or influence or be a part of.
Yeah.
And it felt like when he was like basically comparing lettering for me with that, where I felt like I rode and helped create this like crazy wave that is now happening that I'm so happy that is there. And I'm so happy that so many other people have dove into it and make beautiful, amazing work. But like they should be the ones to carry the wave and I should go find the new wave for me.
Yep.
And so like that was kind of at the core of the kids book thing is like I want to make work that I'm like emotionally invested in that feels like a new space for me. It's clearly not a new space for everybody.
Sure.
But something that I feel, oh, it's innovator's dilemma. That's what it is.
Right.
And so I was like, there's other areas where I feel like I can tick more of those innovator boxes that I think actually matter a great deal for me personally in terms of like feeling self-worth.
I think there's a thing of knowing also where you, you know, a self-knowledge of strengths, where are you best, where do you fit best on that wave, on that curve, you know, because you are right at the beginning of that thing and maybe you're a starter.
Yeah, I think I'm a starter, not a finisher, like for sure. Yeah. Like, I don't want to see things through the end. I abandon books all the time.
Sure.
Like, I was just...
Oh, I do too. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I was just reading an extremely long, like, New York Times article. It was, like, a New York Times magazine article. And I swear to God, I did not read the last three paragraphs of it. Because I was just like, I'm good now.
Yeah, you know, I get like that too. So if I'm in a book, I heard Seth Godin say it like this, like... If he feels like he got the joke, then he's done. Like, if of the book, if like the little seed of what this book is, when I get that, and then the next chapter is like three case studies about it, I'm like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
I get it. I don't need it anymore.
There's some knowledge sets where I do want to just like, just keep
go
going
to the
and
very
absorb
bottom.
As
yeah.
much of it as possible. But it's very few and far between.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I do think that, like, to me, that. Like getting to a place where I feel like I'm innovating or I'm doing something that feels new and interesting is a way to like touch into I'm doing something important, you know, like, and that even though I'm doing a thing that's a commercial thing, like venture or whatever, it feels like it has meaning to it. Exactly. And so that was one of the motivators. And then the other motivator was like looking at my portfolio and going, holy shit, I haven't illustrated in 8 years.
Yeah, right.
You know, and just sort of like...
Because you have mostly just letters.
Because it was mostly just letters. And the letters got less and less illustrative. And that was like by design. And I was interested in it. And it didn't matter. Like, you know, and it was...
Sure.
My work focused in a different way. But it felt like I had let this like core part of me atrophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I need to figure out if I want to rejuvenate that part of me first. And like... Like, when I get that rejuvenated, then I get to decide, like, okay, is this a path I'm going to keep going or whatever.
But if I remember like, early days in your career, you had a lot of illustration.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I started. Yeah. I mean, that's my initial work was all illustration.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I was just getting to this point where it had been so long since I had done it that I was like, oh, man, I feel like I'm at this crossroads where I either, like, leave it behind me entirely or I have to pick it back up again and like refresh it and see if I want to take it along with me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So the story in itself,
story
I'm curious
itself.
Where that comes from. One of the things that my takeaway is from it that I don't know if it's intentional or not, is it's definitely got a melancholy vibe to it. I don't know if you feel that way. Maybe that's just me projecting again, but it feels almost like that's how parents feel. I feel like there's a lot, I don't know if you feel this way, but at the end of a day, there's lots of times your kids are batshit crazy and you're just like, holy, just go to bed, I can't take it anymore. And then they go to bed and you're like, no. And you just feel like, oh, I wish I would have done this or done that. And I your face is making me think there's no intention behind this.
But do you see? I'm like, keep going, I'm interested.
But
it's,
I'm reading into it. It just reminds me of, tomorrow I want to, I'm not a bad parent.
Yeah.
I don't have giant regrets, but it feels like that feeling from the parent side of all the things when they go to bed, you think, I want to do this tomorrow. I want to do that tomorrow. I want to make it. And you didn't do that at all on purpose, but that's how I read it.
Well,
and I also,
I think that speaks though to the fact that like, I wanted to make something that takes something that adults still struggle with. But something that kids also struggle with and address that.
Yep.
You know, like, I think that the theme of it is that setting goals is great.
Yeah.
You know, like, like starting your day and saying, I'm going to go do all these things is awesome. But clearly, as we've already talked about,
right.
like sometimes you don't do those things
yeah.
and then you feel this horrible dread and that you're like, oh my God, I'm worthless. I'll never do this thing. And we yeah. all feel that.
Yeah.
And I think that like, you know, I've been, you know, I talk all the time about being in therapy now, but I feel like there's all these things that come up in therapy that are these super basic things that you have to learn how to do that seem so basic, but are so difficult to actually like enforce in your life.
Like what? Just
like
I know what you mean.
That being one of them. Like you know, this book addressing one of the things, which is letting yourself off the hook.
Right.
If you're not good at something.
Yeah.
Or celebrating that you can love to do something that you'll never be good at.
Right.
You know, like I think that, and that was one of the things that I was thinking a lot about kind of after I made the book, that I don't think that the book directly addresses this enough, but I think a lot about all the things that I have not done in my life because someone told me at some point that I would not be very good at them.
Sure, right.
You know, like how I never took dance because someone told me that I didn't have a dancer's body.
Right.
Or how I never ran cross country because I had a pediatrician tell me that my knees were shaped in a way that would give me shin splints.
Mm.
You know, like we get told these little things about ourselves and we take them in as like empirical truths about us.
Yeah.
And then those things influence the decisions that we make on our lives. And I don't think enough people tell young people or anyone, they don't tell adults, they don't tell anyone that like, you don't have to be good at something to do it and to love it.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, like you can be terrible. You could be the worst person ever in terms of talent at the thing. But if you love every minute of doing that thing, you do that thing.
I feel like you're telling me, Andy, you can go sign up to the community basketball team.
Because totally.
I'm terrible.
Yeah,
but I do feel guilty when I play because I'm like, I'm bringing the team down. But I'm having a good time. Anyway, I know exactly what you're saying. Do you know the... have you heard of the fixed mindset versus the growth mindset?
I feel like from even just saying it, I have an understanding of it, but please
sure.
Tell
it's
me
just,
more.
There's a book called Mindset by Dr. Carol Dweck. I talk about it on the podcast all the time. But it's just basically, there's two general mindsets on your self-worth and who you are, and one is fixed, like your talent's fixed, your IQ's fixed, like, and so they would test kids, and kids that have the fixed mindset, if the task was challenging to them, they would throw it. They'd be like, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
Because if they fail, it's saying you're a failure.
Yeah.
And whereas a kid that has a growth mindset, when they think, I don't know if I'm going to be able to complete this, it gets exciting.
Yeah.
It's like, this challenge is exciting. And so that's like what you're speaking to. It's
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Because if you won't start things you don't know you can't be great at.
And that's what I think the book is trying to address fixed mindset kids.
Yeah.
And saying like, you don't have to be a growth mindset person.
Right.
Like you don't have to get excited about the fact that you failed.
Yeah.
Because I think that like, I'm not that person.
Right.
You know,
yes.
I don't get excited when
no,
I fail.
No, I don't either.
But I can look at failure like with the right context as being like, okay, well, I have to fail enough that I understand this, you know, like
sure.
it's part of the process, you know, and I think that teaching kids with a fixed mindset or like a, you know, dismissive, I don't want to do things if I know I'm not going to ascend to whatever level that like, oh yeah, well maybe you won't, but like, maybe you should try it for a little while.
And do you like doing it?
Do you like doing it?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Where did the idea come from for the book?
It came from, so I see a similar thing in my daughter that I, like she and I are so different from each other, but actually I feel like once she gets out of her threes, we're gonna end up being the same exact person. But she definitely also is like hyper concerned and about like getting it right and understanding things before she does them. Mm. So like, she's not good at free play. Like you can't just put a thing in front of her and go like, go nuts.
Yeah.
She's like, what am I supposed to do here?
Tell me how to do this.
Walk through the process of doing something so she has an understanding of how to do it the right way, quote unquote. And it's interesting because that manifests in really cool ways because she's very interested in like understanding how things work and wants, like she gets really into just hearing about how procedural stuff happens. Like, I think she's going to be like a how stuff works kind of person.
Right, yeah.
But the bad way that it manifests is that she has a hard time like letting herself go and experimenting and trying stuff, which I, you know, these are parallels that I see in myself like crazy.
And this is a big thing, you know, because I'm very similar to you in that way. You know, Eric being someone who will just play and experiment, I think, and I think part of it's like being a rule follower. I don't know if you are, but I am a rule follower.
I'm a rule follower.
And there's something about, that's actually a big hurdle for developing your creativity.
Yeah. Like
if you won't.
And I always test way left brain.
Right, really?
Like way more than right brain.
Yeah.
And part of that is just because like I do feel like if I can just absorb a big enough knowledge base, I'll understand it.
Yeah.
Or if I can walk through the right things, like my understanding comes of a thing doesn't come from like feeling it out and like working through it in a more like esoteric way.
Yeah.
It comes from like just gathering tiny pieces of stuff and then recompositing those in my head.
Yeah, and early on, this was a big problem for me because when I would get a brief, I would want to say, this is what I'm going to do instantly. And I would never play or let something happen.
Yeah.
And being forced to come up with four solutions is a good thing for that. Where I'm like, some of these are going to be trash.
Yeah.
And then those are usually the good ones because, you know, I'm playing and I'm being, you know.
And see, for me, the solutions don't come through play. They come through logic.
Right.
So I walk through that brief and I start dissecting it.
Yeah.
And I start going into like, here are all the asks. Here are all the limitations. Here are all the whatever.
Yeah.
What does that eliminate? And like, so I'm a dissector logic person when it comes to ideation. But because of that, like most of my ideas are not like wackadoo ideas.
Sure, yeah, right.
You know, like I tend to stick pretty close to
I do some more things. Actually, I'm very interested in this whole left brain, right brain. And I actually think I'm usually trying to bring left brain logic and analysis to the creative world because it's bucked that so much throughout time. And actually, there's so much of creativity that's pretty mathematical of the way that it works.
I think it's also like, I think the separation between like a designer and an artist can be an artist is right brain forward and uses left brain to analyze their actions after the fact.
Yeah.
And a designer is left brain forward and uses right brain to expand their actions.
Right, yeah, you know, that's like, really good. Yeah.
Because when I think about the people that I went to art school with, they were feelers when it came to their work. They would like make a thing that just felt like the right thing to do and like let the brush guide them and all this stuff. But then they would look back and dissect their work and go, oh, I did this because of this.
Yeah.
And they would like logic back to the concept.
Yeah.
Whereas designers lead with the concept and have to push the creativity after that.
Yeah.
So it's much harder.
Interesting,
like it's much harder to do it that way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Anyway, I derailed you. You were talking about your daughter.
Oh, yeah. Yes. So she, and it manifests in ways with like play, how she doesn't want to like free play and all that kind of stuff. But also I see it with language too. Like we have a nanny that speaks Spanish to both of my kids. Mm. Ramona's in preschool now, so she's not with her all day, but she understands like super rapid Spanish.
That's amazing.
But she never speaks it back. Like she will not speak Spanish back. I've never heard a Spanish word out of her mouth other than like agua and otro. Those are like the only ones that
have
stuck.
That's awesome. Anyway.
But my son is very loosey-goosey with it. Like he is a total free play nutball.
Yeah.
I'll just hear him just like messing with stuff in another room and he can occupy himself with like a milk jug for 35 minutes.
Yeah.
Like it's crazy. And then he very much mixes like Spanish, non-Spanish words. So I think that he like has this unself-consciousness that she doesn't have right now because I think she and I are like the same person.
Yeah.
And the book then was sort of like it came out of wanting to talk to her and talk to myself, you know, my younger self of like push yourself to do things, but also be cool when you don't do those things because it's hard, you know?
Yes. Man, I wanted to go a million places. I think you saying that makes me think that maybe I developed the left brain approach as like a needing, you know, when I needed to be an adult and earn money. And I feel like because I am a weirdo.
Like a weirdo. Yeah.
I am a weirdo.
And when you say that, like, you're like, oh, I'm pretty conservative in my work. I was like, sure.
Maybe I think I'm doing a good job hiding it. I'm not. But, you know, actually I've been doing YouTube videos. It's been the most fun thing I've done as an adult. And it makes me feel like, oh, this is me. Like I need to, and I think yeah, anyway, that's something I need to think about. And I only verbalize it because people at home might be, I challenge like whatever, you know, how you see yourself. It's good to challenge that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but another thing I wanted to say was what's really interesting for you, I think, is when you have three kids, this happened to me at least, okay? So your first one, you think, oh, they're kind of like this. Or you can see how the DNA is split between them.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, this one's mostly like me or like you in these ways. And then you have the second one. And there's a part of me at least that felt like, okay, these are the options for kids.
Yeah. Like,
this is how, because there's, I don't know, there's, but then the third one is such a weird mixture. You like, the possibilities are infinite, which
yeah.
I'm not planning on having any more kids, but I could see how it's addictive in that you think,
who are
they're
yeah.
all three so different.
Yeah.
Like this, the yeah. possibilities are endless. So it just totally blows you away because you think, that one's kind of like Sophie, that one's kind of like Andy. And then this one, you're like, I don't know who this kid is. This kid's so different than yeah. both of them. Yeah, so it's interesting.
I think like, it's been really cool because you see, like kids are neat because one, they start off looking like clearly one person
true.
And then they merge
right.
into the other person.
Right. Yeah, right.
You know, and that's super interesting just from
very
a physical
weird. Yeah.
standpoint.
Yeah.
But then both of my kids are definitely a blend of the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I are like opposites in so many ways. Like,
yeah,
you know, I'm like an ENFJ and he's
yeah.
an INTP. You know,
yeah,
like we are like fairly yeah. opposite.
But you have the N overlap.
We have the N yeah. overlap. And, you know, we have a lot of stuff in common, similar senses of humor. We're total, like he's a goofball when he lets himself be a goofball. You know,
sure.
it's totally great.
Yeah.
But we have traits that we feel are like unique to us or unique to our like family line or whatever.
Yeah.
And then we see those kind of coming out in the kids in different ways.
Uh-huh.
You know, like I have always made jokes that Ramona is like pure Mashmeyer.
Yeah.
Because she was like so serious as a baby. Like she's just like the most,
right.
like she's super intelligent, but
yeah.
like super serious and like
yeah.
can't take a joke and all this stuff. But now she's getting so fun and like
yeah.
weird and imaginative.
Yeah.
And I think it's like they take on these different properties and they just merge into different personalities as they age. It's so interesting.
Yes. So the you said that, so the book came from something that you wanted to say to your past self, basically.
Yeah.
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 And I do think,
one of the things that I really, like, one of the things that I love to think is that no one is so unique that there are not thousands of people that are also like you in the world.
True. Yeah.
You know, like, I actually, like,
yeah.
love thinking of myself as not being very unique.
True.
You know,
yeah.
like, and to me, that means that if I want to make a thing that's just for me, it's actually for also thousands of people.
Yes.
You know, and some people are weirder than other people and have less people that are like them, for sure. And so,
well, some of those artists, too, yeah. are people that we like to gawk at. Because
yeah.
we're like, whoa, how weird is that?
Yeah.
So there's the other stuff. Yeah.
But like,
yeah.
you know, like any time that, I just remember when I first moved to San Francisco, one of the things that bothered me so much was like anytime I had a complaint about a service that I used or whatever, like the feedback that I would get is like, oh, well, you're an edge case because you're not everyone's experience.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, but I'm not like Kim Kardashian.
No, yeah, right.
You know,
yeah.
like I'm not like
yeah.
so unique of a person on this thing that other people are not also experiencing the same pain point.
Yeah.
And so like when I think about things that I personally want to do that are driven by who I am or who I was, I know that there are thousands and thousands of kids and people that are exactly like me in
yeah.
certain respects.
Yep.
And so like I can make stuff that's very personal to me, but is also very personal to a lot of other people.
Getting into that authenticity of writing what you know.
No, yeah.
on an emotional level of like, I know this is resonating with me, so therefore it's going to resonate with tons of people or however
yeah,
many people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think like people get tripped up by trying to make work that is for a person that they don't know.
True.
You
which
know?
Is always pandering. It's always
yeah.
like, here's what you want. I'll make
yeah.
Yeah. I know
like,
exactly what you
there
want.
There are
yeah.
I mean, clearly there are times when you have to visualize an audience that
sure.
is very different than you.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and
yeah,
when it comes
yeah.
to client work, there's no way that everything that comes down your path is
yeah.
a thing that's made for you.
Yep.
And that is all about like being able to really envision a person
sure.
that is that person,
yep.
you know? And
but
like,
you're often the best expert on communicating to people with a similar flavor to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And clients that hire you to do work that speaks to people like you because it's like a PR-ish kind of thing or whatever, Like, they are smart in doing that.
Very much.
You know, like, yeah. They know that work that you do that is personal to you is going to be personal to the people that like the work that you do and are similar to you.
And all the people on the podcast are going to be really sick of me saying this, but you haven't heard me say it, so I'll say it. But I keep thinking, one of the things that's like a mantra of mine when I make something is, I don't draw the t-shirt that I feel like drawing. I draw the t-shirt I'd want to wear.
Yeah.
So there's an empathy of getting into, because if you just draw whatever you feel like drawing, it's not always a good design. It's not always like this is, you know, but I feel like it's interesting that you got such a, from that firsthand experience on a gut level, being able to know what your kid would like or what you would have liked as a kid, that's where this idea kind of germinated.
Yeah. That's and right. Even then, yeah. What's interesting is like, it's not the right book for her.
Sure.
You know, like she likes all kinds, like my son loves it, you know, like because he's like the same person as me, actually.
Right.
Like
yes,
she's,
right.
She and I are similar in certain respects. Like she's going to be a total boss when she's older. Like she's like a way more like, you know, just decisive, determined.
She's like, get my coffee.
That yeah, kind of, exactly. Yeah, like we make jokes that she's gonna like run a hospital or something. Yeah. That's gonna be like what she does. Yeah. And like my son is just much more just kind of like goes with the flow, easy peasy, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But he it's so fun because he loves my illustration work. It's really? So funny.
Oh, that's amazing.
Like anytime he sees a piece of work that I did, he like loses it and he gets really upset when I have to put my computer away or something like that if
that's
he
amazing.
Sees a flash of it. It's really cool.
Yeah.
But like Ramona ended up not being my audience. Like she wants to read about monsters and wants stories with bad endings and like wants to have me tell her about like what happens when you break your arm and things like that. Like,
but it's funny that having her made you get into that perspective, and it did resonate with the kid that's most like you. So it, you know, yeah. But okay, so my last question, because we've been talking for quite a long time now, is what did you learn about? Do you have time?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
What did you learn about making a kid's book? Because I'm guessing your experience is similar to mine, where the people that want to do kids' books and making a kid's book, and it's a long line of people.
Yeah.
It's a heavily guarded system. Every system that people may not realize this, if you've never tried to get into one of these markets, whether it's TV or kids' books or whatever, it's heavily guarded. And obviously you had a lot of things going for you with your already having a career, but with that, with having a New York Times bestseller, with, you know, getting published, whatever, all of those things, let's make a little list.
There's just so much.
I know,
so much.
Sorry to start that at 1 hour in.
No, because I think that one of the first things that I always lead with when I talk about, like, people that want to make kids' books is, like, for one thing, making books in general is never going to be financially viable as your only thing.
Right.
You know, like very few people can make a living.
It's not a great incentive.
It's not. No. There's financial cannot be your incentive. You cannot start a project and go, oh my God, I can't wait to cash those checks. Because those checks are going to come in like, you know, three-figure form every quarter
years. Yes.
And like, it's a long game.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, I think one of the things that I've been super interested in like passive income as a thing my whole career.
Yep.
Because I feel like having as many fingers and as many pies as possible has been very helpful to me.
Whatever. Yeah.
You know, it's been helpful to me in terms of like community stuff, like being involved in the web community and the type community and the illustration community and the design community. Like having my finger in all of those pies has been really fulfilling to be able to have like diverse conversations and act as a mediator between my field and other fields and things like that. So that's been really cool. Having my client stuff be varied enough that I have like big money projects that help pay certain bills and low money projects that help fuel the creativity and some things that are these like slow burn passive income things and all of those things.
It's an ecosystem.
It's an ecosystem.
Yeah, that you, and I talk about that a lot too, is that you need, I mean, that maybe is just the day that we live in where it's going to be hard to make a killing at editorial illustration or whatever.
Well, the thing is, you can make a killing at it if you work your ass off, you know, like,
and you're number one, or you're one of the, it's your thing.
There's, you know, there are parts of our field where you can make good money at it, but it requires so much time and so much effort that, like, eventually you won't have that
right.
to spend.
You won't, yeah.
You won't.
Totally true.
And you need
yeah.
to be thinking about, career-wise, how are you going to like, adjust your career to match your life,
yeah.
you know, over time.
True.
And it's really good to start thinking about that and, like, not, like, planning for it or even taking active step towards it, but understanding that's a thing that's going to be a part of your life.
Yeah.
And so, like, kids books and book publishing in general, to me, has always been in this category of, like, hey, this is never going to be a cash windfall. This is going to be a slow burn for me.
Yeah.
And that's cool because the hope is that I make something that is powerful enough and has staying power enough that it can remain evergreen for a while.
Yep.
It's not a flash in the pan. But then there's a pressure to that of like, oh my God, I have to make something that people are still interested in 10 years and that I'm not totally mortified by in 10 years.
True, yeah.
Because like that's one of the issues with publishing and kids books mm-hmm. is that like it's much easier to get over your earlier work when it was just like for a random client.
Yeah.
But like, if you make a typeface, right. that typeface is out there in the world literally forever haunting you.
Yeah.
And then it's the same thing with a book. You know, you're going to, if you write in a book and you have like really specific opinions and stuff that are in that book, those things are going to stay like ever. Like people are going to think that you said them yesterday.
Yeah.
If they picked up the book yesterday, even if you said them 15 years
which
ago.
Which is a weird thing. Some people will go back to early episodes of the podcast, which were only 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And say, oh, I was listening to episode 35. And I was like, why? Yeah. Why did you do that? Like, I don't stand by it. I don't know. I'm, you know.
I think podcasts do that too, because when people fall in love with a podcast, they go through the whole catalog and they just
I took the first 100 off and put it behind a wall. Where you have to sign up for the newsletter because I'm just like, I want only diehard people to be in
that
there.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, but, and then because of that, there's this pressure when you're making this thing that is very different than every other thing that you're making.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I think like, know that if you're going to get into making kids books or get into making books in general, like you have to be fully emotionally invested in whatever that thing is, and you have to understand that this thing, in the best of times and best circumstances, it outlives you.
Yeah.
You know, who you are in this moment.
I think, so I feel like being all in emotionally, in term, you know, first of all, just in like, you really want this. You really want to do it, because it's a hell of a thing to break into. But then also, I think it's really it was a fascinating exercise for me. When I realized people were gonna go back and listen to early stuff, it actually, about 2 years in, changed how I approached it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say I've never had a crucible moment in my life where I became more myself, because I realized I have to stand behind
mm-hmm.
this. And so a lot of other stuff about me disappeared, because I was like, I'm not willing to stand behind that. Like, and so it's crystallizing.
I think that's really true. And what ends up happening to you is that you don't make flash in the pan decisions. You don't just like ship it because it's good enough.
Exactly.
You know, there's all this stuff that you put into a project where, like, I think especially with a kid's book, like, the more you pay attention to the details and the more like meaning and gravity that you bring to every single word, to every single piece of every single
It's a puzzle
image,
too.
It's a puzzle. The more that project will like, it will feel good to you.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah.
You know, because you know that you spent every possible brain cell like agonizing over every detail. And I think that knowing that it is such a hard field to break into, despite the fact that even if you break into it, it is never going to be the thing that like buys you a house.
Right.
It's never going to be that thing.
Yeah.
You know, the pressure really is on, because it does kind of feel sometimes like you're taking someone's like seat that wants to be there really badly.
True.
And I've noticed that I never feel like there's a wall. I haven't really felt like there's that much of a wall in illustration or in certain kinds of design, but like in publishing and kids books, there's totally
a real wall.
There is a real wall.
Yep.
And the criticism and judgment within that world is much harsher
totally.
Than it is within design and illustration.
It's more like music or something.
It's more like music, but it's like if music had a real, like music is a cool industry and there's a wall because it's hard to get into and hard to be successful and people want to make sure that like only the cream floats to the top. But I think with kids' book stuff, you're talking about something that can have like a very intense impact on a young person's life.
Yeah.
And they want to make sure that the garbage does not get in.
And they're very, it's a very precious place for them on an emotional level, on a personal level.
Yeah, and so they don't want people approaching it
willy-nilly.
They don't want someone coming into the field being like, oh, I can make whatever I want because who cares? The parents will buy it.
Yes.
Like they want people that come in understanding just how important the work is and how like the books that we kind of take for granted that have been in the system for a long time actually address really intense things.
Yes.
Like,
true.
Like Ferdinand the Bull.
Yeah.
That book addresses a really intense topic. Which is like being born into a world that you don't belong in.
Yeah.
And that's so crazy.
Totally.
You know, and like we don't stop and think about those things very much, but like the power that something that message can have is like crazy.
Yes.
And so you can, that's why there's such a wall. You know, there's such a wall on it because there really is this ability for these things to have a really, really visceral impact on people's lives.
Yes. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Okay. Is there any other things that you missed in terms of tips, tricks, whatever, about approaching
the tips,
it?
The other tips that I'll give about just like publishing and stuff in general is like not everybody needs to go through a publisher.
Right.
You know, like if your book has a really specific audience, like if you're making a book about design, just self-publish it.
Sure.
Because if you already have your design audience in front of you and can reach them really easily, you may as well make all that money.
Yep.
No reason not to. Agreed. Unless you like have absolutely zero ability to do fulfillment and don't want to handle it.
Sure.
That's a totally different thing.
Yeah.
Because you're going to do all of the work of promoting that book anyway.
Yep.
And so the only reason to work with a publisher is because you have a really good conversation with them about what you want out of the relationship and they're able to address those things really directly. Because they are going to make the majority of the money off your book and you're going to do the majority of the work on the book and you need to have this like, we're in it together vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I definitely wanted to publish my kids' book through a publisher because I felt like it'd be easy for me to sell a book to designers, but I felt like the book had legs outside of the design world and
you're going to have no distribution outside of your
audience. And like there's no chance that it would get into the other people's hands that aren't just in the design community if I didn't like put it out there and let that happen.
Yep.
So that's one thing that I would really consider in terms of publishing anything, you know, and other designers would say the same thing.
So. True. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to pry anymore. Thanks for doing this. This was great, of course. And I really appreciate you coming up here and spending a huge chunk of time chatting.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. I could talk for hours.
Thank you, friend, for coming over to my studio and chatting with me. I had a great time hanging out as usual. Can't wait to hang out again soon. Hope it's real soon. If you don't already follow Jessica Hish, go check her out on Instagram. You're not going to be disappointed. It's going to make your feed so much more enjoyable and infinitely more gorgeous. Thanks again for coming on the show for part two. Can't wait to record part three. Thanks to Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme music. Thanks to Alex Sugg for providing the Creative Pep Talk original soundtrack volume one. Thanks to Chris Graham for production assistance and mastering. And thanks to all of you for listening. And until we speak again, stay pepped up.